Assalamu alaikum. You're listening to She Speaks Academic Muslimas. This episode features me. It's the end of the semester and I'm beyond burnt out, but even in this final sprint to the finish line, a line that just repositions itself each semester, I know, there are moments of pride and joy. One of my students in my Islamic thought class, Shannon Strom, is also a student in my colleague's class, Professor Alison Reihel's class on philosophy of gender. And for her final assignment in philosophy of gender seminar, Shannon Strom interviewed me in a podcast format on gender and academia. So in this episode, we talk about being a woman of color in academia, being a STEM student in a patriarchal environment, performing professional norms of femininity, and how we have to overperform on every scale, standpoint theory, intersectionality, and of course, the future of gender relations in academia. I'm so proud of Shannon Strom and of so many of my students over the past years, like David Favre and Chase and Zaria Whitlock and Kyla Tinsley and Tasbih Habal. The list goes on and on. They give me hope for the future. Anywho, better not to get emotional. 2 weeks from now, I'll be launching season 5 with an amazing lineup of brilliant Muslim women in academia. Until then, enjoy this episode.
Can I have you introduce yourself first?
I am Saba Fatma. I'm an associate professor at SIUE in the Department of Philosophy. And in general, my research interests involve Muslim American issues within feminist theory and critical race theory.
Thank you. I'm so excited to have you participate today, and I'm really looking forward to hearing your answers. So then I guess we'll go ahead and get started with that first question. Can you describe how being an academic philosopher has shaped your views on gender, and have these views changed over time?
Definitely have changed over time. Reading different texts have definitely opened up my mind. I read an article in grad school. I don't remember the name of that article. It wasn't The Compulsory Heterosexuality by Adrienne Rich, which I do remember, which is another excellent article, but it was about how all heterosexual sex is necessarily patriarchal in nature, because even when women think about their sexual desires and think through them, the desires themselves are formed within a framework of patriarchy. So at that time, like, I was really young when I read this and I had never been sexually active. And when I read that, it was like a wow, like it was like a epiphany bomb in my head. So that was one text that really impacted me and changed my view of what even women's empowerment, and I put empowerment in quotes here, means. And then there was another reading I did in undergrad, which kind of even got me into feminism. And again, I don't remember the name of it. It was a book. It's funny that I don't remember the text, the names of the text that had the most impact, but it was about Brazilian women who were wives of miners, and they organized labor, they organized around labor concerns of their husbands and their town. And it kind of introduced the idea that, yes, feminism could speak to me and could speak to a life that I was familiar with, and that addressed some of the concerns that I was also concerned about, labor concerns, women in their daily lives, navigating capitalism and such. So those really shaped me and changed my views on gender, on feminism. And of course, Simone de Beauvoir and Judith Butler's views on gender also shaped me heavily, but they also made me realize how colonization over time has led to the erasure of the spectrum of behaviors associated with the spectrum of genders. So colonization actually ended up erasing the spectrum of gender in Global South. It was like a step backward for many in Global South indigenous cultures. But I will also say that even as a child, I was a feminist. I just didn't have the language to articulate the injustice. Even as a child, I knew that women and girls were dealt unfairly in life. And that's something that I notice in my daughter as well. Now that she's a young kid, she recognizes that she is not getting similar opportunities as her brother. And I want to provide her the language so that she can make a case for it. But I think grad school and academia in general has definitely shaped my overall views on gender.
Yeah, that's so interesting the way you talk about, like, not having the language to articulate your experience and how you were, like, observing the world. That's something that I can definitely relate to, and something philosophy has, like, helped provide to help make sense of things. So historically, philosophy has not been the most welcoming to women. Can you describe why or how you decided to pursue philosophy as a career? And I know you changed from STEM to philosophy. And so I was wondering if your gender ever played a role in any of those decisions.
Gender was precisely what was on my mind going from computer science. So I was a computer science major, and I was like about two courses short or one course short of a math major, but I wanted to graduate early because of financial concerns. And my upper division CS class, computer science classes, and my math classes were just not very conducive to women. There were very few girls in my class, and all the guys were like besties and cheated off each other and had like this camaraderie that we were not a part of. And a lot of the times we would give suggestions in the class, and those same suggestions would be so much more meaningful when they were repeated by and accredited to like a male peer student of ours. And so I was like, it really used to leave me deflated. I didn't really connect to patriarchy in that sense. I just thought maybe I'm not smart enough. But I also knew I was smart because I got amazing grades in high school and I was really good. Even in computer science classes, I was doing fairly well, but it didn't like inspire me to do something greater or anything of that sort. And then my first job that was in the field of computer science, my boss ended up being terribly racist. And that also, like, just going in and earning that paycheck and programming whatever thing that he needed us to program day in, day out. And the paycheck was good, but I couldn't take his comments. I was like, this is not what life is about. And I can't do this. And I started applying to grad schools. And so being a woman really shaped the decision to go from computer science into philosophy. And the funny thing is that, you know, my mom at the time when I started applying to grad school, and she said, why? I said, I want to do something for women's rights and I want to fight for women's rights in Pakistan and stuff like that. And she's like, you know, you can do that without a PhD, right? You don't need to go to grad school for years to fight for women's rights. And retrospect, I think she was probably right, because now that I'm inside academia, sometimes I feel kind of disconnected with grassroots movements that are happening on the ground, where people are bargaining collectively together with whatever structures of powers that they're situated within. And I'm just sitting here using language like bargaining with structures of power. You know? So I'm using these jargony words here while they're actually doing the real work. And I know that there is value in the theory. Obviously, there is value in the theory, because it gives you the language, it gives you the concepts, it gives you ways to articulate and categorize how all these oppressions intersect. But at the same time, I do think that there's something to be said of academics being involved as like on the ground worker within liberatory movements and not just theorizing. But the other ironic part of you saying philosophy hasn't been more welcoming to women, I thought CS was unwelcoming to women. But now that I'm in philosophy, you know, you see many of the same patterns. It's there, maybe obviously things have gotten significantly better since my undergrad days, but it was not something that was just in STEM fields. It exists all even through humanities, the unwelcoming feeling.
Yeah, I have a really similar experience from like going from STEM to philosophy. And I was just describing it to one of my classmates yesterday, because for the podcast, she's interviewing her roommate who's a STEM major. And I was telling her about how, like, when you say something, it's like nobody pays attention to it. And then a man comes in and it's like, oh, it's the greatest idea on earth. And then you act like it's like a reputation to be passionate and like want to do real things like in the real world. And that was like a major shift for me, like for philosophy too. But I was very shocked at like the patriarchy that still existed inside of philosophy. But that's what I really love about like my experience at SIUE, because I feel like this is the most diverse faculty I've ever been exposed to, especially in philosophy. Like, this is the first year I've gotten to read a person of color that's a philosopher, the first time I read a woman philosopher, the first time I had a philosopher of a color as a professor, the first time I had a female professor. And like, that was very foundational and like instrumental to like forming what I want to do in the future too. So like, it's interesting how you say that you're not like on the front lines of things, because from my perspective, like you definitely are on the front lines of things.
Oh, thank you.
Like, yeah, no, of course. Like, especially your class in particular, like education is definitely how we change minds. And then by changing minds, that's how we're going to change the world. But first you have to do the mind thing. And that's like exactly what you do with your work. And I think that's why it's so impactful.
Thank you for saying that.
So it kind of like goes into our next question then. Are there any norms in academia that you feel like you are expected to conform to on the basis of gender? In our seminar, we touched on Judith Butler's notion of performativity. Do you find that there are different expectations for performativity based on gender, like in academia or even in philosophy more particularly? Because like, I know there's kind of like this gatekeeping issue with philosophy, as in like what counts on philosophy. So I'd be interested to hear your input there.
When I think of performativity, this incident always stands out in my head. In grad school, I did a 6-month internship in the New York State Senate. I got an opportunity to present on a topic that I was passionate about. I don't even remember what the topic was anymore. Anywho, I actually bought 2 suits. I didn't own any suits. Obviously, when you're a student, you know, you're like broke, and my stipend was $7,000 a year when I started at Binghamton. And so I bought these 2 suits, and I used to basically change up the shirt and wear the same 2 suits, and you know, on different days. And I bought basic colors so I could interchange them. And I wore one of those suits for that presentation. But I was so passionate about this topic that I ended up, through the course of the presentation, initially I was sitting upright and with my legs crossed and all that quote unquote good stuff. But through the course of the presentation, my back slouched in a C curve. My legs were wide apart by the end of it. I was slouching downward with my arms on my knees, the way that what we associate with a guy who's passionate talking about a subject. And I was like, you know, just laying it all out for the state senator on why this issue is important. And toward the end of it, I realized what had happened to my composure, right? Like, as I was like so like into it. And I think I was also had started sweating, but I had my coat on obviously, but you know, I realized like when I left his office, I kind of felt embarrassed that I was unprofessional. But then later I was thinking that no, guys present like this all the time to him. Why am I feeling like it's unprofessional not to be prepared? It's not unprofessional to sit a particular way and have a particular steady tone of talking and blah, 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 whatever, right? But in that moment, it brought in some embarrassment as if I've acted unprofessionally. And that kind of stood out to me to guide me on what I even consider professional and unprofessional. Then in grad school, also, I noticed like some of the grad students who were male would show up in jeans and t-shirts, whereas some of the women grad students would dress up a little bit more formally. And I was even told by somebody in my faculty that, hey, you know, you don't dress like a student, you look like one of them. But then the guys would dress like students and they would hang out like one of them, but their authorities wouldn't get challenged, but ours would be like, why are we doing covering this material? Is this like philosophy and so on and so forth? As if the student, the undergrad, is essentially challenging. This actually has happened to me at SIUE too, where in a philosophy class, and this is when I'm an assistant professor, an undergrad is like saying that what I'm covering is not philosophy in my philosophy of race class, and that this should not be categorized as a philosophy elective at all. And so definitely your authority as a knower of philosophy is challenged more often, I've noticed. And what I started doing when I was younger as an assistant professor is I would dress more formally at the beginning of the semester. And then as the semester would progress, so I would dress more formally to sort of establish my authority in class that, hey, I am a knower of things. Take me seriously, please. So not authority like as in I'm here to rule you, but like I'm a knower of things. Don't challenge me on every minutia because it kind of disturbs the dynamic of the class even before we've gone into a discussion. And then by the final exam, I would be in jeans and t-shirt. And now Now I'm more relaxed. As I just mentioned, I'm sitting in my pajamas. So now I'm far more relaxed, I think, because I look older, I have more confidence, I have less of a imposter syndrome and such. But initially, I definitely felt the pressures of performing to certain scripts. Oh, and another thing about performing certain scripts and performing certain ways, I also think that a lot of times people of color are often expected in their lectures to be also entertaining. And initially in my career, I found that a bit exhausting. Now I'm not so much focused on that, but I had this idea that in order to be a successful professor that is beloved by students, you have to also quote unquote entertain them. And that was a pretty toxic idea for myself as well. Now I teach, I mean, even then I was teaching things I was passionate about, but now I just focus on what makes me passionate about this particular text. Can I convey that passion to the students? Can I convey why this text is interesting?
I was just telling my mom like how every reading in this text, there's just been like a central claim that is like just a takeaway claim. Like sometimes it's hard to find philosophy that does that. And especially when you're bringing in something like Islamic thought to people who have literally never touched this stuff before, I'm sure it's like very challenging to pick out readings. But like I've learned more from your class, I feel like in one semester than I have in an entire semester previously. So like it's been really like fun even. So I like appreciate the work that you have put into like getting here. It just like is disheartening that you had those like obstacles to get to this point. Well, thank you for that answer. Let's go to the next question. Can you recount a notable way in which power structures like patriarchy, white supremacy, et cetera, have shaped academia that have personally impacted you?
Yeah, so I can mention some of them because, you know, I'm still here. But I will say that as a woman of color, you prepare for the worst. And I went to like some kind of workshop or something where one of the speakers, one of the people that stood up, I think she was a lawyer and she was a professor of law. And she said that when she submitted her tenure dossier, and this is in the time when things were not electronic, she had like 4 massive 2-inch binders that she put on the department chair's desk and said, here's my tenure dossier. Tenure dossier, when you're going from assistant to associate, covers about 5 years of your service to the university or your teaching career or your research and such, right? So she had like 4 or 5 binders of 2 inches each, or maybe even thicker, but anyways. And the chair looked at her and said, am I supposed to read all of this? And she said, not if you're going to give me tenure. And that kind of stuck in my head. And she said, prepare for your tenure packet as if you're preparing for a lawsuit, because you want to be able to think about every challenge that you're going to get. And I think that kind of stuck in me. And then even here at SIUE, I have friends who are in different committees who have told me these horror stories of women and women of color and even men of color who've come up in their departments, and the weirdest things have been brought up in the discussion in order to promote whether we should promote them to associate or full rank or not. The strangest things, like some of them, I can't, like they sound so archaic, but anyways, so that was one particular way. And I was just showing this to my son and daughter just actually day before yesterday. I was showing them my 5-year plan from when I started here. Well, I actually started my 5-year plan like in my second year. And they're like, you drew out every single year? I said, yes. And I said, you know, you need 3.5 points in my department to get tenure, 3.5 points from publication, 5.5 from everything put together. But I had like double, triple the points just because I wanted to like have no doubt. Like there would be nothing that they could say to deny me at any point. So that was one aspect. And then the other thing that has impacted me that I'm much better about now is that when I was earlier in my career, I would get a lot of requests to speak here, speak there, go to a church, go to a committee, go to a here, all to do with like, could you tell us a little bit about Islam? Could you tell us about this that you're researching, so on and so forth? And I used to say yes to them because I thought of it as an obligation to undercut prejudice, undercut racism, sexism, so on and so forth. I do still say yes to a lot of things, but I was certainly overwhelmed. When I would mention all these things that I was doing to service the larger community, a couple of people actually said to me, well, you mentioning them in your narrative or in your tenure packet or in your point system, whatever, sounds like you're trying to grub for points. You're trying to go credit grubbing, like, you know, you're groveling for it. And I, you know, now that I'm on committees myself that evaluate other professors and such, white professors mention their diversity work like it's like, I don't know, they've opened the gates to heaven or something for other people. But when people of color do it, we are seen as just simply talking from our experience and not from expertise. I have a PhD that specializes in feminist theory and critical race theory with a focus on contemporary social and political Islamic thought. This is not me talking from my experiences as a Muslim. My experiences as a Muslim inform me, but I actually have expertise in it. But if I mention the things that I do for the larger community, they apparently are not seen as service to the community. They're just seen as me, I don't know, talking about my life in some blasé fashion. It took me a while to realize that that was happening. And now I'm more careful about what I say yes to and who I even mention to, why am I doing it? The intent has to be clear in my own head before I take on any endeavor.
That's interesting that that happens for tenure cases. I didn't know that that was like, I know tenure is a whole other ball game, but I guess I didn't really factor in that it's different for people of color and it's different for women, which that seems to be the trend everywhere. But yeah, gosh, it's just so overwhelming to have to like always have to deal with this. I'm at a loss of words, honestly, but like that story.
I don't want to discourage you though. It is a very fulfilling job. It's better than like a lot of jobs, but, and job market is another topic that is filled with exploitation. I don't want to go into that. It's another discouraging topic, but I am one of the privileged ones who have made it to a tenure track job where I am now an associate professor. Definitely, I hold massive privilege in that fact.
Yeah, I'm glad you put it that way, but still distressing to like think about how far we've come and how far we still have to go. Like, mm-hmm. Still a lot of work to be done. So I guess like you kind of touched on this a little bit, but do you feel as though some individuals are better situated to speak on or write about certain topics?
100%.
Yeah. And then maybe could you go into like how that informs your work in philosophy?
100%. Some people are better situated to speak and write on certain topics. Our lived experiences inform our worldview and what we are exposed to. You know, in philosophy, we call this standpoint theory, but you don't need to know the jargon to understand the basic concept, which I think everybody would agree to. So for example, as a person who lives here in Glen Carbon, I have very little idea what farm life is like. And one of my students would know better farm life is like in rural Midwest America. I don't know what kind of hardships an American Midwest farmer has to face. If I was writing about that topic, I would be writing about it from a very sort of detached theoretical perspective where I won't really know the nuances of what it is that I'm writing about. Similarly, my location as a woman of color, as a brown person, as a Muslim, as a heterosexual, as an able-bodied person, as all the other social locations that I have inform how I look at the world. And that knowledge is not something that is just that just comes from me occupying my social location. It comes from actually consciousness raising. It comes from actually me critically reflecting in my own role as, for example, a worker within a capitalist mode of production, for example, or as a cog of patriarchy, or as an upholder of white supremacy. What is my function? What is my role in that? So oppressed people and oppression can be on so many different levels, so many different axes of your identity. Like I said, your disability, your gender, your race, your religion, all of those things. The oppressed person doesn't possess this critical viewpoint, doesn't possess some magical insight or magical knowledge in virtue of their oppression, but through an evaluation of their function within the collective system of whatever system of oppression they're thinking about. So I think most definitely, I think I remember when Sonia Sotomayor had given this speech where she said, like, you know, a wise Latina woman with her experience would have like a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life. And then in her confirmation hearing for Supreme Court of United States, people kept coming at her like, are you going to be more biased to Latina women? Are you saying that you're better equipped than Latina men, or are you better equipped than white people to like rule on matters of justice and law? And that was not her point at all. She was saying, I have lived a particular life, and so have these white rich judges who've grown up with trust funds and have whose family members have stakes in different companies that then they're going to rule on in cases that deal with eminent domain and you know, Citizens United and so on and so forth. So all these laws, the white judges are coming at it from their own perspective, and then so is she. She's simply acknowledging what she brings into the picture. And here's the other part of the standpoint theory. The other part of the standpoint theory that I think is, yeah, so white people might have their own standpoint, and then people of color might have their own standpoint, able-bodied have their own standpoint, disabled-bodied might have their own standpoint, so on and so forth. But people who are oppressed have to necessarily know the standpoint of the dominant out of necessity of survival. Just to survive in this world, I already know what the standpoint, because it's taught to me from birth. The dominant perspective is taught to me from birth as if it's the only perspective. Whereas the non-dominant perspective is not taught to us, right? And so yes, oppressed people, whatever axes of oppression that they might be living under, have a more comprehensive or more morally informed view of the world than people who occupy dominant social locations.
That was the perfect answer. And I loved how that like tied into the reading that we did that from yours last week. Well, I was thinking about like how the rhetoric around that is like still happening with Rachel Levine, about how like conservatives and right-wing rhetoric is saying how she won't have like an unbiased opinion in healthcare. There's no way that she could achieve equity because she's more concerned with trans people's healthcare and LGBTQ healthcare. And it's just like ridiculous that they think that she has a bias, but somebody else wouldn't also have that same bias, but that bias supports the hegemonic masculinity and the power structures. So then that is okay. But when someone else does it, it's like, this huge commotion.
Yeah. You said it. I mean, I remember there was also a case where there was a gay judge ruling on some matters of marriage, and people are like, no, his sexuality is going to inform his decision. Well, the heterosexual judge's sexuality is going to inform their decision. Like, why now? Why are you so gonna? Because it's going to disturb the hegemonic, the status quo, the, you know, the dominant view.
So like the power structure thing has just been like, You mentioned this too when you were talking about STEM. Like I knew what I was experiencing, but I chalked it up to like me not being good enough, me not fitting in. And then once I got to philosophy, and specifically philosophy with like you and Dr. Reiheld, and I got this like term intersectionality, like embarrassingly, I had never heard of that term before, but it explains so much that's like going on behind these power structures. It's just been like really foundational to hear like you guys talk about this kind of stuff, and especially to see you write from like standpoint theory, because like I was always told not to do that, that you're being biased when you're doing that, like you're being too passionate, it's making your rationality blurry kind of thing. And to like see you do it and do it so well, like gives me, it's just very like I feel very like validated in the things that I was doing previously. So like I appreciate you doing that and like talking about this. So.
Definitely. And I will say this, that what I have done over the years is I've immersed myself with other women of color, other feminists who do intersectional work and who are concerned with a form of intersectionality that speaks to me. And that has really helped me a lot, because now I'm not defending constantly why we need to do what we're doing. I'm immersed in resolving the issues that are near and dear to me without being on the defensive constantly. So I think that's something that with time you realize, like, hey, I don't need to be wasting my energy here. I need to be immersed in, you know, people who similar political and social values in that particular way. Like they are also committed to fighting against injustice in a way that is intersectional.
Yeah, I'm happy you have that group, because it can be hard to find, like, when you're starting out. I know from experience, and I'm like glad that you were able to find that. I hope I'm able to find like a similar group somewhere. It's just like with the pre-med culture is just so toxic. I definitely can't do that. I thought we were going into healthcare to help people. Turns out to not be the case for most people. Like luckily I found a few friends, but I like still like really do want that like group of people who are just like, I don't need, like you said, I don't need to like justify or defend why mm-hmm. I want to do what I do. Like we all understand the importance and the value of it. And therefore like we just get to exist without having to feel like we have to explain ourselves for doing so. So that ties into my last question then too. What ways would you like to see academia's relationship with gender change for future generations? And I know that you have children yourself. So like what kind of like barriers did you have to face based on like gender maybe that you wouldn't want your daughter to have to face?
So a few things. One would be my go-to answer for thinking about change is always listen to grad students because they will help guide the way. Don't obstruct them. As academics, as professors, we shouldn't obstruct their path by bureaucracy and such, but rather we should be clearing the pathways for them because I really do think that a lot of grad students have concerns that really speak to exploitation, that really speak to injustice in a way that professors cannot speak to, especially because the professors, like I am an associate professor who got a tenure track line, but I know equally smart and smarter people who were unable to do that. And so the people who make it into tenure track lines are already, I mean, to me, it has nothing to do with meritocracy, most of it. And so I think that a lot of times assistant associate professor people on tenure track line kind of buy into the idea that, oh, we made it because we worked hard. Everybody's working hard in grad school, man. I do think that grad students can see issues and speak to issues in ways that sometimes that we as professors should be then facilitating. The other aspect that I would want to change, like if I think, do I want my kids to go into academia? I also think that the academic job market in general and grad school experience in some cases, but not all, but in many cases, definitely the job market is so exploitative. Like it's so demoralizing to apply to all these places with a PhD in your hand and be willing to locate year to year from postdoc to postdoc, hoping that you get a tenure track line, relocating your entire family. I mean, I wouldn't tell my children to subject themselves to that, because it really precludes having a healthy whole life with your family. And so that's something I think academia definitely needs to change. And how does that relate to gender? It relates to gender because, you know, I know there's a study that showed that men who are married, marriage actually helps their tenure case, their tenure path. Whereas women who are married, it detracts from their tenure clock. So we bear the brunt with those exploitative work conditions. Even in our home lives, we end up bearing the brunt of that. Whereas a guy moving his entire family, he still has a quote unquote supportive wife, make his journey possible. Whereas for women, you know, there's a lot of resentment that gets built into heterosexual relationships and patriarchal relationships in general. And so, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to subject my children to that. I think that the job market in academia is quite exploitative. We need to make it such that people can lead whole, wholesome lives where fathers can be fully fathers, parents can be fully parents, be fully present and not constantly working around the clock in order to make it to their next permanent job. And then the last thing that I want to say is that that we have, when we think about feminism and when we think about gender in particular, we have to then think from an intersectional lens. And what I mean by that is that we have to take into account how all these different aspects are completely inseparable from a person's gender. Like whether you're able-bodied, an able-bodied woman is completely inseparable from being a woman and being able-bodied. I mean, the two go, they cannot be separate. So your concerns, I think for feminism to be truly fighting for any real justice, it has to consider socioeconomic levels, poverty, which neighborhoods do you live in, you know, your race, how police interacts with different folks, or your immigration status. You know, I mean, there's so many, or what it means to be an American in relation to global South and how we impact other countries. All of that has to be considered when we consider the category of gender. Gender cannot exist in a vacuum. It has to exist with all those categories in tandem, and it's inseparable from all those categories. So yeah, so those are just some random thoughts that I have about change in academia.
No, I'm so glad you said that like last little part there. I was hoping that we were going to get to that wording in particular about how like gender is not static across the intersections of gender, race, class, culture, religion. There's things that are going to impact that. So when we are talking about feminism and doing a feminist movement, I think it's really crucial that we don't repeat history with like white women dictating what feminism is. What's it for? Like we read Mickey Kendall's Hood of Feminism, and she talks about like what issues are feminist issues, and she talks about like safety, security, housing, healthcare. Like these are the issues we should be concerned with, not like as a woman. Like let's worry about like all us being safe and secure so that we can work towards like human flourishing instead of like, being at each other's throats and being so divisive all the time. So yeah, your answer was perfect there. Thank you, Dr. Fatima.
No, thank you for having me.